KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on another edition of Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas School of Law. Ned is a scholar in the areas of copyright and technology law broadly. And today we're going to be discussing an area of copyright law that I think is of extreme relevance to consumers and people that interact with technology and that attempt to do things that may be outside the norm of intellectual property law. Ned has a terrific article that has come out in the Indiana Law Journal called Copy Traps. And we are going to be discussing today what a copy trap is. What is copyright law doing with respect to the activity of users of intellectual property that we would not expect or perhaps want copyright law to do? Now, one of the major areas, of course, that we're familiar with and that we've discussed at some length on the show is, of course, illegal downloading. But this is an issue of downloading that goes far beyond the simple idea that, well, you're stealing a piece of copyrighted material without paying the authors and others their appropriate fee. Because as we think about, and I'll have Ned define what he means by copy traps, there are broader issues involving speech and liability and punishment fitting the alleged crime and other areas that again go to our basic questions of what are we really doing with intellectual property law and do we want to keep on doing it. So with Ned's article, Copy Traps, Ned takes an extensive look at these different areas with some examples that I think should be of interest to anyone that interacts with technology and then more broadly people that think about intellectual property law generally. Ned, by way of background, teaches property law on the Internet and Decedents Estates at University of Arkansas School of Law. I will tell you that we will be discussing property. We will be discussing technology. I have no intention of asking Ned a single question regarding Decedents Estates in this interview. If you want that part of Ned's repertoire, I guess you'll have to contact Ned directly and have that conversation. As an undergrad, he comes with a background in philosophy and economics, where he got his degree from Brigham Young University. He got his JD from Harvard, where he was a member of the Journal on Legislation. And he clerked for Judge Edith Brown Clement on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He practiced law at Bakers and Botts LLP in its appellate and complex litigation sections, representing clients in matters of intellectual property, internet trespass, international real estate, and insurance fraud. And his scholarship covers broadly intellectual property and internet law. And as I think about it now, I'm pretty sure, Ned, that I litigated at some point in my practice life, either with Baker Botts being on the same side or perhaps on the opposite side. But we'll put those past issues aside and merely welcome you today to Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on the show.
And Ned, thank you again for taking the time. I should say publicly that I think you, and there have been a few other people who would be contenders for this award, but I think you get the award for the most patient guest of Hearsay Culture, given the logistical issues, which were of my own making. So I thank you for your patience, and I'm excited to have you on the show today.
Well, it is an honor and a privilege. As I told you before the show, I view this, the Hearsay Culture, as the letterman of intellectual property, the letterman show of IP, so it's a great honor to be on the show.
Well, you know, I appreciate that compliment. I think Dave Letterman has done more in journalism, especially in the presidential campaigns, than most journalists over the preceding 6 months. However, I can guarantee you that I will not be setting up anything you do as a top 10 list. So I will limit my use of Letterman, but I appreciate that compliment. Ned, let's start off with more about your background and what I always ask authors. And before we get into your article, how did you come to focus on these issues? Why are they of interest to you?
Well, this particular issue, there's a bit of a funny story behind it. In my first year teaching here at the School of Law at Arkansas, I had the opportunity to visit relatives, my immediate family, over the Christmas break. And as I was going home, I had a conversation with my sister, and she informed me about a a great new website that she had discovered where she could download music for a very little cost. And all indications were that it was a legal website through which she could download her favorite songs. And I said, well, really? And she said, yes, you have to take a look at it. So I got online, looked at it, and sure enough, it was a website offering pirated material that she thought was legal. And so the background of, well, why did you focus in on this copyright issue on the internet, it goes back to this little incident that I had with my sister, and then I had to her dismay, inform her that, in fact, this was an illegal website, and she had to be careful downloading, well, that it was against the law, despite the representations that were made on the website, for her to download these music files. So that's the funny story. It was a Christmas break going home, and this whole incident with my sister that made me think, you know, perhaps there's some a scholarly article here about strict liability on the internet.
You know, it's amazing how often those kinds of experiences lead to good ideas. And I think, you know, this article definitely extends to those kinds of unknowing and perhaps totally unanticipated violations of law. I'm curious, you know, before we get into these topics and discuss copyright in more detail, how your, you know, classroom experience or your experience as a dad has colored your analysis.
Well, definitely the students in the classroom, if we had to take a vote, they would be on the side of fair use and weaker intellectual property rights, at least as applied to the internet. And it's been it's been interesting to discuss arguments on both sides in the classroom. And that, but it, I mean, the having the students close by and relating experiences helps to remind me of the real world application where, you know, the poor college student trying to do something creative, that it really is true that I live the experience as a teacher here at the law school firsthand, and hear some interesting stories about copyright troubles that my students may run into. And so, yeah, perhaps that does color my perception and my views, but what can you do? And as well, of course, being a parent and talking to other parents, my children are not old enough to be on the computer yet. Give them a couple of years, but in conversations with other parents, hear of the honor high school student who didn't realize there was something wrong with downloading 200 songs, and it literally was just over 200 songs, and then seeing the punishment inflicted,
right,
and hearing it from the parent's point of view. It does, I think, I should disclose, it does create a bit of a bias and a rethinking of the laws that we have to govern rights of exclusion on the internet.
The article is Copy Traps. The guest today is Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas School of Law. Ned, on Hearsay Culture, we've had a number of guests on to discuss copyright generally, but I still think it's useful to ask you this very, very basic question. In terms of the general definition of copyright, what is copyright, and how generally does it apply in the sectors in which we are going to discuss and that you discuss in Copy Traps?
Right. So copyright represents a property right or a right of exclusion that the law enables authors of expression to exercise over that expression. So it essentially says, I can exclude anyone from being able to copy or otherwise use the expression that I have created. I can forbid them from using it without my permission. And the purpose of copyright then is to create an incentive for people to create expression whereby they will then sell or authorize others to be able to use their expression for usually monetary gain. So copyright provides a financial incentive by giving authors a right of exclusion over the expression that they have created.
The copyright itself, when we think about it, one of the areas that you focus on, and it's really my question leading to the question of what do you mean by copy trap. But before we get to that, your article focuses heavily on what we call strict liability. And I think especially for non-lawyers listening, what is strict liability?
Sure. Strict liability essentially is a rule that will say that if there has been an infringement of a right that occurs innocently, where the person that has infringed the right does so under a mistaken belief, or otherwise we would say they have acted based on a mistaken fact. There was a mistake of fact about what was true and what the circumstances actually were. And so they were acting innocently, thinking that the facts before them were one way, when in actuality, the situation was different. What strict liability does is it will attach liability to the actor, regardless of the fact that they acted innocently or they acted under a mistaken belief. Right, if I, if I purchase a stolen piece of property and I'm doing it in good faith, I thought that the person that was selling it to me had authority to be selling it. I thought it was theirs, when in fact it was stolen. Well, the true owner can get that property back from me. There's liability on my part. I have to give the property back to them because the liability is what we call strict. And if I want to keep that property, I at least have to pay compensatory damages to the true owner. Now, the person that sold me the property would also be liable, but oftentimes they've skipped town or somehow unavailable, and we can't go after them. And so, in that instance, the true owner might go after me under a theory of strict liability. That even though I had the mistaken belief that it was good property, the person that sold it to me had good title. The fact that my belief was mistaken doesn't shield me from the fact that I'm liable to either give that property back or to the true owner or pay the value of that property to the true owner.
So to bring those two concepts together, I think, is how we can get into your basic title. So what is a copy trap, or what do you mean by copy trap?
So copy trap is fairly simple, where here we have an internet user that mistakenly believes that it's okay to copy something off the internet when in fact it's not. So perhaps we have an internet user that goes to a website that the website represents that, sure, this is a legal website and you can download music off of it. We're authorized to sell it. And in fact, perhaps the website's charging money for it. This is the exact situation that my sister encountered. And she went to this website and saw music for sale and she could download it at a pretty good price, but she still had to pay for it. It represented that it was legal. She downloaded it. But in fact, the material is infringing on the copyright. The copyright owner has not authorized that website to be offering the music on its website. So copy traps described the idea of strict liability on the internet with respect to copyright liability that attaches. And the most often occurrence would be where copying on the internet is when we download, right? Wherever we are downloading a file, we have to make a copy of that. And so what copyright law says is even if you don't know that the website was an illegal website, you're still liable. And even if it appears that it's a legal website, you are still liable for the content that you've downloaded.
The issue of copyright and downloading is one that I think many listeners will be familiar with. I mean, certainly anyone that uses technology has probably at least heard of Napster or just the idea of downloading generally and the prevalence of YouTube and other sites that allow users to upload content would suggest that this is a prevalent issue among consumers generally. But there's also a sub-issue here, is there not, of other ways that one could unwittingly create a copyright problem for themselves. So what would be a couple of examples of those? And of course, one that I'm thinking of is just the basic idea of surfing the internet. So can you perhaps give us an example or two of situations that are copy traps in the sense that the user isn't even aware necessarily that they are implicating copyright law?
Well, the surfing the internet, I think that's the parade of horribles example that, to be honest with you, I don't think there's a court that's going to say you're liable under strict liability for merely going to a web page. Mm-hmm. However, that being said, a court, I think, is going to, despite the fact that it's strict liability, a court would find a way out, perhaps invoke the fair use doctrine, innocence or mistake of fact is not a basis for invoking the fair use doctrine, I would be surprised if a court didn't find some way to somehow excuse the copying that it so innocently occurs when we go to a website. And specifically, right, where we're at a website and in our cache memory, there's mm-hmm. a copy of the expression that's at the website. And if we have infringing expression just right there on the website. So perhaps easy example, we have a poem that is put up on the website without authority of the poet, right? And so when I go to that website that has this poem displayed there illegally, somebody's put it up there without authority of the copyright owner, I've made a copy of that poem and the appearance of the website into my cache memory, and so under strict liability, I've made this copyright unknowingly and not knowing that it was infringing, and even not knowing that it would be there when I got to the website.
Right.
And so yes, I think technically, if you were to read strict liability, take it to its logical end, that there would be infringement there, although I think it would be, I think we'd have a hard time finding a court attaching liability based on such an extreme example of innocuous conduct.
Right.
But nevertheless, it's a good illustration to say that, wait, the law is set up. If we are imposing strict liability for any copying activity on the internet where there's not express authority from the copyright holder, the law is set up to impose almost punitive-like damages for this very innocent activity. And so the cache RAM example, and I mean YouTube is a great example as well. You go, you run a YouTube clip, and there is a copy that you are causing to be made without authority, perhaps, of the copyright owner. Well, under strict liability, you would be liable. But that's the parade of horrible examples that I don't think a court is going to go that far to say, well, we're going to it would effectively attach liability to all of the internet, and we could never do any surfing
right
whatsoever. But I do think the more realistic possibility is that the active downloading, where you have, you download a file thinking that the website has authority to be offering it, when in fact it does not. Mm-hmm. And there, the mistake of fact, I don't believe, will be any type, will get you anywhere with a court, because the law is pretty clear and there is an affirmative action of downloading the file, as opposed to just, it does not seem as an affirmative act to merely be browsing the web.
You know, the issue, of course, of web surfing, I think, is a fascinating question of law, and I certainly agree with you that the likelihood of being prosecuted for surfing the web seems remarkably low, if not zero. But I think it does illustrate a basic problem with the law in the simple fact that as we sit here, and the show is being recorded on February 17th, 2009, we do not know clearly, definitively in the law, whether the law allows such behavior, putting aside the practicality of actually being prosecuted for it, which I think reveals one of the major and one of the big problems with copyright law that you identify, which leads to the follow-up question, of course, your thesis. What are you attempting to achieve? What is the core of your argument in copy traps? And then after the break, we'll drill down on some of the more specific arguments and points you make.
Sure, right. Well, my ultimate proposal is that, look, this, the law needs to change here for reasons of fairness and for certain constitutional tensions that it creates, and also a few other policy reasons. The law just needs to change. And ultimately, I propose that there... That liability, sure, it could still be strict, but the idea of excessive damages, or damages at all, for that matter, that are monetary, needs to be shed, that the law should no longer impose exemplary or even actual damages for instances where innocent infringement occurs on the internet. And so the liability that is there would simply require the innocent downloader to delete the content if there is an infringement that occurs and it's the person is made aware of the act of infringement after having had a reasonable belief that it was lawful to, the facts were such that their conduct would have been lawful. I propose that the requirement should only be that the person delete the content of the material that they've downloaded. And if they don't, then at that point it becomes willful infringement and statutory damages apply in full. And the rights holder, of course, can use the legal process to ensure that once notice has been given that the downloading was illegal, that at that point, once the notice has been given and they no longer can assert a mistake of fact or innocence, the rights holder would have the ability to follow up through normal discovery procedures to ensure that the act of deletion has been complied with. So I guess the short answer to your question is, where am I going with my argument? What's my ultimate proposal here? And that is, well, I think that the law needs to change, and no longer should liability for downloading, no longer should that liability require damages, either exemplary, punitive, or actual, for that matter, in that, okay, we can hold on to the strict liability, but it should merely require those people who, under a reasonable mistake of fact, think that what they're downloading, that they have authority to be downloading it, they should not be held to the standard of actual or exemplary damages.
We're talking to Professor Ned Snow, author of the article Copy Traps, that has come out in the Indiana Law Journal here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU FM Stanford, and KZSU FM is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the webpage for the radio station, and click on Donate to KZSU. Especially in these lean times, I recognize that asking for donations is not an easy thing, especially since taxpayers are going to be shelling out billions of dollars in a effort to buttress our financial system. But despite that, I do hope that you consider, after you've made your direct donation to the U.S. Treasury, that you consider making a donation to KZSU. And regardless, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU. Ned, one of the issues that, or news articles, I should say, that have come up in the last couple of years involved a website called All of MP3. allofmp3.com. Can you tell listeners a little bit about allofmp3.com and how that story and that situation fits into the rubric that you described before the break?
Sure, yeah. So All of MP3 is an interesting scenario to discuss in a strict liability context, because there the website looks to the average user, to the reasonable man standard, it looks like it's legitimate, or so it would seem. There's, I don't know, I can't remember if there was an affirmative representation that it was legitimate. At a minimum, implicit in its appearance was this representation that it could legitimately offer music for download, and for a very minimal cost as compared to other name brand websites that you go to, like, you know, the iTunes or such. This is offering music at a much lower rate. And so when you look at the website, you say, well, you know, it might be that these people have authority, and so I should be able to download it. Now, on the flip side, though, there's a strong argument that, you know what, anybody looking at this website should be able to tell that it's a pirated website, because in fact it was. And why? Because who would be able to offer pop songs for a nickel a song? In that the prices were so low that the reasonable person, it's arguable, would be able to say, no, this cannot be legal. And so in my proposal for saying, well, if there is a reasonable mistake of fact that could have occurred, I have proposed that this is a fact question for a jury to consider as to whether the circumstances of the website suggest that a reasonable person could construe that this website had authority to offer the copyrighted expression. And
The copyrighted expression, to be clear, is the song itself.
I'm sorry?
The copyrighted expression, just to be clear for listeners, is the song itself.
Right, yeah, yeah. Thank you. So whether the All of MP3, did they really have authority to be offering a song, a pop song here for a nickel a song? Well, the reasonable person looking at that, my own personal view, I don't think so. I don't think that the reasonable web browser is going to, or internet user is going to view that, and as a factual matter, is going to think, oh, they must. Here's a great website to be able to download songs from, and the songs are offered for 2 cents, and they're the pop songs. But I could be wrong, and it's a question of fact for a jury. And this is what I am proposing, that where a mistake of fact is arguably occurring, that it could be occurring here, these questions need to go to the jury, and the jury determines. And if indeed there was a reasonable basis for concluding that someone could look at that website and say, oh yeah, they have authority to be offering the music or the the book or whatever it is, that the downloader should not face the excessive damages which the Copyright Act now imposes on them. And a perfect example is, let's consider Google Books, right? So Google Books offers books that are in the public domain for anybody to download. Well, what would happen if accidentally, inadvertently, somehow, a copyrighted book got on Google Books and it was offered in its category of public domain books? Now, obviously, the book publisher would want to go after Google for making the offer. The question that I ask is, should they be able to go after the end user as well? And I think there, as a factual matter, that, yeah, the mistaken belief that Google had authority to offer this book for anybody to download, that it was within the authority of Google, that perhaps the copyright holder told Google, go ahead and offer it, I think that mistaken fact would be reasonable. And so it's going to depend on the circumstances unique to each website as a matter of factual determination as to whether a reasonable mistake actually would exist that would excuse the innocent downloader from excessive liability or financial liability, for that matter.
You know, you mentioned the issue of the damages themselves, and I think one of the startling things that comes out of your article, but that may not be readily apparent to average or you know, typical consumers of this content, is how the damages are calculated. So how are copyright damages calculated in the scenarios that you describe? Assuming that one is found to be liable for copyright infringement, how does that calculation work?
Right. So damages can be, they can be calculated either as actual damages or statutory damages. And more often than not, especially in the music context, we'll see copyright holders asserting their right to statutory damages, because the statutory damages are set anywhere from $750 to $30,000 per infringing copy. Now, the Copyright Act does recognize a provision for certain expression that is copied innocently. They say, well, okay, we'll go down to $200 per infringing copy. But still, I mean, even at $200, that adds up very quickly, especially where all it takes is a simple click of a mouse to make one copy. Think about it. If every time you click your mouse on the internet, you're liable for a minimum of $200 or even $750 per click. And so the damages oftentimes, they can be, I mean, perfect example is, again, music. So where somebody downloads a song that the market value is a dollar, but they're going to be liable, say, $200 for the innocent infringement, that's 200 times the value of the song, and as so you, or 700, or perhaps it'll be at $750 per song. I mean, and again, it's just grossly excessive of what the actual damages are.
And that's a startling number. I mean, especially putting aside that exception, that not only are you talking about 200, assuming the iTunes model, 200 times the value of the song, but perhaps 750 times at a minimum. And it leads to, I think, an important point with regard to damages. We could generally think of that excess amount of money between the actual price of the song and your awarded damages as something along the lines of punitive damages being awarded, the deterrent damages to deter wrongful behavior. Is it appropriate in the instances that you describe to view the Copyright Act as incorporating punitive damages? And if so, isn't that a problem with respect to the innocent downloader, as opposed to someone who intentionally, quote-unquote, is seeking to violate a copyright law, or conversely, someone that knows that they're violating the copyright laws?
That's an excellent question, and I hope I can do justice in the few minutes to cover adequate ground to answer it.
Well, we have about 20 minutes left. So,
Let's look at the common law and where punitive damages are imposed there. First of all, punitive damages are never imposed for innocent conduct with respect to strict liability unless the conduct is somehow willful or wanton, or the conduct poses a great risk of harm to innocent actors. And this is the common law, which is different than what is governing copyright law here. And so, for example, if I manufacture a defective automobile or somehow I am innocently acting that places a great amount of people in harm's way, well, okay, the common law said we will recognize strict liability awarding punitive damages. But other than that, where if the conduct is not willful or wanton, and by definition, innocent downloading cannot, I don't believe, can be termed willful or wanton. And it doesn't pose a great risk of harm to many innocent actors, which I don't believe that the innocent downloading does that either. At common law, punitive damages were never imposed where the liability was strict. And so it makes us ask, which you did, why then does the copyright law impose punitive damages where the conduct is seemingly innocent? And the reason, as best I can tell, is because, well, the governing Copyright Act was passed in 1976 when there was no internet, right? Or at least as we know it today. And circumstances of 1976 were much different today, which seemed to justify the idea of punitive damages for innocent conduct with respect to copying. Specifically, innocent copying in real space before the internet, it was very unusual. The quintessential example is subconsciously copying something that you've seen someone else create. You forget it that you saw this piece of artwork, and then you go to do the piece of art, and subconsciously you copy it into your own. I mean, very unusual circumstances where innocent infringement would occur in real space. And the reason for this is because the reason that it's unusual is because the method of distribution that copyright holders employed to get their works to end users was based on physical delivery, right? So the easy example or the easy case scenario is, well, I'm an artist and I want to get these music to the public, general public. How am I going to do it? Well, I'm going to use music stores, and they're going to have to go out and actually buy the CD, and there's physical procurement. And so the innocent copying, well, copying or innocent infringement, I should say, innocent infringement, there really was no usual circumstance where it would occur in real space. And the result of that is that it was seen as an excuse that was easy to allege but very difficult to disprove. So at the time of the passage of the Copyright Act, Congress is sitting there thinking, well, we have this excuse that, it's easy for someone to say, well, any situation where it would be applicable, such as subconscious copying. Well, anybody could easily allege that, but it would be very difficult to dispute that or disprove it. And moreover, the copyright holders can distribute their works to people without relying on the people copying those works. They just go and buy the physical copy, and there's no copyright liability for purchasing a physical copy that is infringing. Okay, mm-hmm. So they said we're not interfering with any distribution methods of the copyright holder getting their stuff to the people, and if the excuse ever does come up, it's very unusual, and it would be easy to allege, difficult to disprove. We could see it seems likely that if anybody's going to allege it, you know, they may not be telling the truth. It's very isolated, so we'll go ahead and treat it as though it were an act of, you know, regular infringement, and regular damages therefore would apply. Well, along comes the internet, and that changes a lot of the factual assumptions that underlie the reason for strict liability in copyright at the time of the passage of the 1976 copyright, or even it had been in place before, for many years before that as well. The internet changes the factual premises for the reason of having strict liability in copyright, and that is the internet. Through the internet, the distribution model whereby the rights holder is able to get his works or her works to the end user, that distribution model relies on the end user making a copy, right? So now innocent infringement can occur under the very circumstances that the legal distribution is supposed to happen. Innocence is occurring in the usual circumstance, the copyright distribution model for which the internet is set up to facilitate. And unlike in real space, where innocence occurs here, where innocent is alleged here, where a downloader says, well, you know, I was under a mistaken belief. It's easy to disprove that. You just have to look at the website and you can tell. And the trier of fact can look at the website and say, well, yeah, this would support a mistaken belief, or absolutely not. Everybody right. knows that this would be infringing activity just by looking at the website. So in an allegation of innocence, unlike in real space, in cyberspace, it's much easier to disprove. In real space, we have to get inside the guy's head and see if, in fact, there was subconscious copying going on. Here, we just look at the website in cyberspace. And so the main factual premise that is different about the internet than real space is the idea that the distribution model for copyrighted works relies on end-user copying, where in real space it does not. And so therefore, when we punish innocent downloading, we're punishing a user for relying on what the normal business model is for copyright distribution on the internet. And so the reasons for having punitive damage, strict liability in copyright at the time that the Copyright Act was passed just simply don't hold up when it comes to innocent copying in cyberspace. Hopefully, that was a mouthful. Hopefully you... and your listeners were able to follow that. I'd be happy to field a follow-up question if you have one about that. But that's the crux of the argument for why strict liability arose in the first place and how it does not transfer over. Those reasons don't transfer over to internet technology.
We have about 10 minutes left here on Hearsay Culture, chatting with Professor Ned Snow, author of the article "Copy Traps" in the Indiana Law Journal. Ned, I mean, I think you cover a lot of ground there. Although I was able to follow it, and hopefully listeners were as well. So I think it was cogent and clear. But I do have a follow up question, which is really because of the lack of congruence that you identify, because copyright law was not written in a way that anticipated these relatively easy forms of copyright violation, or unknowing forms of copyright violation, or innocent forms of copyright violation by way of internet usage. What is the current state of affairs on that front? In other words, what is Congress's justification, or how does Congress, if it is, or the courts addressing the imposition of strict liability for internet activities? Is it simply that that is the law and therefore strict liability applies, or have you seen Congress or the courts recognizing this difference and attempting to work around it?
Well, unfortunately, from my perspective, we don't see courts paying attention to this argument. We've seen a strict liability, very simple arguments being raised that, you know, like to be able to get to a jury or to determine whether, you know, this is a mistake of fact. And the court just matter-of-factly strikes it down and says, ah, but strict liability is no defense in copyright, and they move right on. We don't see the judicial reluctance to enforce this on the Internet that I believe the Constitution, in fact, demands. And if it's okay, David,
yes.
I'll just give a little summary as to why I think the Constitution does demand the courts step in and take a more active role.
Please.
So there's a few constitutional tensions that arise. From an abstract perspective, the reason that they're arising here, Congress hasn't done anything at all. I just stated that the courts didn't. Well, neither has Congress since to alleviate this problem. But on the other hand, Congress has. By failing to do anything at all, what we have is Congress has effectively changed traditional contours of copyright by failing to change the rules that govern copyright so that it can further the policies of copyright, because now the policies of copyright are being turned on its head. The copyright policy is being turned on its head because of changing circumstance, not because the law has changed, but rather because the law has failed to change to accommodate these changing circumstances which the law is now being applied to. So, and more specifically, okay, so what are some of the tensions that are arising by this failure to accommodate these changing circumstances, and how are traditional contours being changed by the failure of Congress to act? Well, first off, there's a huge speech issue here, because strict liability effectively impedes the free marketplace of ideas on the Internet. So if you imagine that strict liability is enforced very harshly by all rights holders on the Internet, would we feel a little bit of a reluctance to download anything? And truthfully, I know people that are reluctant to download much off the Internet because they hear about all these, well, they hear about the RIAA suits, and I don't know if I'm allowed to call out specific names of rights holders, but they're afraid because maybe they get to a website and they and it'll turn out that they're going to be liable for what they download. And so what we have here, where's the speech issue? Well, the website, the person that actually has a legitimate website that's trying to get their speech out and get people to download their speech, now the strict liability has chilled that ability for them to get the speech out there. People are reluctant to download their speech. And more in the other side of that coin is that, okay, so on the one hand, the author's right to speak, who's the website owner, they can't get their speech out. So the virtual pamphleteer, you know, can't get people to actually download the virtual pamphlet.
Right.
And then the other side of that coin is that the downloaders have a right to receive that speech. And strict liability impinges on that right to receive. There's a Supreme Court case, Smith versus California, where the Supreme Court said, hey, we can't have strict liability for obscene attached to booksellers who possess obscene material. We can't say strict liability because now the booksellers are going to be afraid to carry anything that's close to the line here. We're going to and whereby the general consuming public isn't going to be able to get something that might be arguably obscene but isn't quite. And so if we take that reasoning and transfer it to the Internet context, Here, strict liability is not against the bookseller. The bookseller is the website owner, and they have protection under the Digital Millennial Copyright Act. The strict liability is actually against the consuming public. It's like punishing people who go into a bookstore and buy the obscene material and punish them strictly, which the court said we can't even do with respect to the bookseller because of its effect on the consuming public. Here in copyright law, we're going after the consuming public itself, whereas we have we already have built into copyright law a rule that excuses innocent conduct on the part of the website owner. So there, why wouldn't we have it for the consuming public? Free speech issues. Due process is another constitutional issue that arises. And before I go into it, I should pause and say, are we out of time yet?
I will stop you when we are. I should tell you, though, we do have about 5 minutes left. So, of course, this is the time of the show where things get wildly unfair because you just brought up due process, which, of course, we could spend the next year discussing. So instead, what is the due process point in about a minute and a half?
Okay. Well, due process, right, says that strict punishment, there must be a rational relationship between the law and the government interest. And here, you know, the government interest is to further dissemination of knowledge, provide these monopolies to rights holders so that in the end, more expression will be created and get out to the people. Well, the problem is that strict liability on the internet is deterring innocent conduct, and not only innocent infringement, but innocent legal downloading. So this rule actually deters that conduct which we're trying to further, and so the law just is irrational, which raises due process issue. And moreover, another due process issue comes from the mere fact that the punishment is grossly excessive. So Supreme Court in BMW versus Gore and State Farm has said, okay, where you have an excessive punishment on a tortfeasor, if it's too excessive, well, I guess by definition excessive is too much, but it can violate due process. And they look at three things: the reprehensibility of the conduct, and well, obviously innocent downloading is not reprehensible, the ratio between the actual damages and the assessed damages, and here, you know, we're contemplating at least 750-1, and the court has cautioned against exceeding a single digit ratio, it would seem to violate due process, as well as another factor that they look at is penalties in comparable cases, and I think a comparable case is the BFP who receives stolen property. We don't treat that BFP in real space at common law. We don't attach these type of punitive damages.
And so to be clear, when you say BFP,
definitely a due process concern on two grounds: the rationality of the rule and the excessiveness of the damages.
And BFP, just to be clear, means.
Oh yeah, bona fide purchaser. Okay. For value.
Okay. Let me ask one last question, which is going to take you literally. I'm going to ask you to answer it in 10 seconds. So the content industry says digital piracy is rampant. We're losing money hand over fist. So we need to give as much rights and hold on to as much rights as possible. And you respond in 10 seconds.
I say, well, yeah, where the infringement is clear, yes. But punishing the innocent will actually hurt you.
We're talking to Ned Snow here on Hearsay Culture, author of the article Copy Traps, that has just come out in Indiana Law Journal. Ned, this is a fascinating area, and I invite you back on the show to continue the discussion because I think this is highly relevant to general users of technology, and I appreciate you taking the time. For those people that want to learn more about your work or your next project, what can they do? And I know you have an article that you're working on now, so again, in about 30 seconds, what's that article about?
All right, yeah. Thanks for asking, Dave, and thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
I'm now looking at the burden of proof in the for the fair use exception to copyright liability. And who should bear the burden of proof? Should it be the copyright holder or the fair user? And explore issues there. If you're interested in seeing that, I have a draft up on SSRN. It's been a fascinating subject to look into and explore, and of course encourage your listeners, if they're at all interested, please download it, and I promise they won't be liable, that I have authority to offer that on the SSRN website for free.
And Copy Traps is available there as well, is that
it
right?
Is.
Okay, terrific. Well, Ned, I look forward to hearing about that article next week at Drake, and again, I thank you for it, and I look forward to seeing you at Drake next week, and I thank you again for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for taking the time.
And thank you, David, for having me on the show. I certainly enjoy the show, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to talk to you.
My pleasure, Ned. Thank you so much. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture. Among them are Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch. I'm also looking forward to talking to, this show has already been recorded and will air next week, my conversation with Andrew Lerman and Wendy Seltzer about the Tor Project. I'm looking forward to talking to Professor Paul Heald from University of Georgia on copyright issues, as well as Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Down the road, we'll be talking to Professor Mark Lemley and Dan Burke about their new book involving patent reform. Professor J.B. Boyle from Duke University will be on to discuss his book on the public domain. A number of Canadian copyright experts and intellectual property law experts and technology commentators and journalists will be on the show, including Professors Michael Geist and Ron Diebert, as well as Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing, and who is an extensive and fascinating theorist and writer in technology. Professor Gary Small, author of the book iBrain, will be on the show as well, discussing the impact of technology on the physiology as well as the operations of the human brain, and Professor Michael Heller as well from Columbia Law School. Additionally, down the road, once the book comes out, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan from University of Virginia will be on discussing his upcoming book, The Googleization of Everything. As always, you can listen to Hearsay Culture a number of ways. You can pick up the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows, as well as blog commentaries and the schedule. The best way to listen to the show, of course, is by listening live on KZSU in the Bay Area at 90.1 FM, or by picking up the show through streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show through the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford by clicking or typing Center for Internet Society into the podcast search engine in iTunes. And there's also an RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where you can pick up not only Hearsay Culture, but other events and speakers at Stanford Law School, hosted by the Center for Internet Society. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to further diverse programming here on KZSU FM Stanford. Have a great day.